Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
Welcome to Agile for Humans. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. We bring awesome people together to share their ideas about agility in today's fast-paced, crazy world. We examine current Agile tips and practices with the goal of ultimately trying to help you, dear listener, become a better Agile leader in your organization. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and subscribe on Patreon at ryanripley.com. As always, thank you for supporting the show. The reason I'm able to bring awesome people to the podcast is because all of you out there share, like, and support the show. So please keep it up. It's always appreciated. We're always taking your questions and comments about the show. Email ryan@ryanripley.com. Leave a comment on the website. We're happy to talk about these things and get back to you. All right. Joining me today, we have a murderer's row of agilists. That's the old Yankees reference, I think. Don Gray, how are you, sir?
Doing well this morning, thank you.
All the way from South Africa, Barry Tandy. Barry, how are you?
I'm very well, and you?
I'm excellent. It's always great to see you guys. And now, hey, from Amitai Schleyer, coming live from, where are you in Germany?
Northern Germany. The closest town is Hamelin, home of the Pied Piper.
There you go. So he's Pied Piping somewhere. An international edition with Don and I just being, you know, at our houses. Not bad.
Well, now hang on. I'm at the intergalactic headquarters of Nth Order Systems.
I've heard that. Yes, and I'm at the global headquarters of Ryan Ripley and Company. This is big stuff. But guys, thanks for joining in. Always great to hear from the three of you. I heard Don's become a heretic. Don, what are you up to? What is going on with you? What's brewing in that brain?
Well, so anything else you want to hear? There, I'm done. What's been brewing in my brain? I just got back from Europe, and so I'm still sort of Dane Bramaged. So I think I'm where I was still back in May and April, where I'm just flabbergasted that we still have problems doing software development. And if you take a look at the simple aspect of, I have a request, so, and I talk to, let's say, Amitai, and go, hey, Amitai, I need this. And Amitai goes, okay, cool. And he develops that for me. That's software development in the small. Once you start to work with software development in the large, suddenly you have a lot of other things that come into it, into software development, beyond just fingers on the keyboard. You know, there's the old, why isn't Johnny coding yet, saying back from when I started 30-something years ago. And Tim Ottinger, who's, I believe, been on the podcast, has decided and done the math, and it comes down to typing is actually like 1/12 of the work.
Right.
So there's other things such as teamwork, personalities, organizational structures, and all. There's a lot of things that impact software development. And we're not talking about most of them, other than perhaps going, wow, that just really doesn't work well in this organization. And so what I'm trying to do, where I'm looking now, is to find ways to bridge the gap between the great ideas and the manifesto, because the Agile manifesto, and I'll get to the heretic part in just a minute, has some great values. I love the values, but there's no instructions on how you do this. How do you do people and interactions over process and tools? So this is where I'm trying to be, is acknowledge the value of the Agile manifesto and realize that there's no way we can do this. We need to have both and not either or. So people don't, you know, is Agile a mindset? Is Agile a set of practices and techniques? Well, we need to be both and. And where I think we're either or right now with Agile, you know, we're either way up here in the value system, which I think is a good value system, or we're down in the process and tools, and there's nothing connecting the two of them. Be sure to talk to me after the Agile 2018 show. I'm going to actually go through all of the vendors, and I'm going to categorize them into whatever buckets they fall. Like, is this a tool vendor? Cool. And I'm just going to see how the market is implementing the Agile values.
So, Don, I have a theory for you.
So yes.
Because you've posed this question to me a few times over the years, and we've talked about some of these things before, and it finally hit me this week. I had a conversation with someone in management. I won't out the person, but I actually believe that the difficulties are intentional, that we're actually doing it on purpose. And here's what I mean. The majority of my career is rooted in the Fortune 500 or multi-billion dollar companies. And as I think about the systems of work there, we have intentionally dehumanized the work. We create very strict standard operating procedures. We have very stringent practices. We have playbooks. We have task templates. We have all of these things that are designed to turn a person into a commodity. All of these things that we're trying to create that allow us to switch one person in for another. And people do that because they think it's for controlling purposes or consistency purposes or to become predictable, whatever it is. And the intern effect of it, even HR practices are designed to commoditize people. And now suddenly we have a workforce that we believe is like an interchangeable part. And when we treat people like that, when we dehumanize the work, when we remove the values, principles, emotions from all of our frameworks and practices and interactions and ideas, I think you get exactly what we have now.
We do get exactly what we have now. The question is, I guess it's a therapy question, and I'm guessing because while I might should have been in therapy, I never have. But the phrase goes, and how is that working out for you? So we have this process or this habit of creating this idea that people are fungible. A great book on this topic would be Tom DeMarco's Slack. He talks about the fungibility of programmers, developers, and the fact that we need Slack in the system. So for the book notes at the end, Slack by DeMarco. It simplifies the thinking that's required to create or to manage people and manage projects. The issue is it hasn't worked well. It didn't work well back in 1984 when I started. It's not working well today. People are wondering, why are projects always late? Why are they over budget? Why is quality low? Why aren't I getting the things? Why aren't the users getting the value they want? It's because we're thinking this way. And Max Planck said something that science advances one funeral at a time. It's not that the people change their minds. It's just that they die and people come into being, or people move up in the management layers who have a new way of thinking. So my generation, it's too late for. We either think this way or we don't. It's the generation, it's the 30s and 40s right now, where we need to be focusing our work to bring about these new ideas, this new way of understanding that people are not commodities, that you cannot just swap them in and out willy-nilly, that teamwork is crucial for developing complex applications, and I will confess or admit or whatever state that the applications we're doing today are light years different and more complex and more intricate more difficult to bring into existence than the stuff I was doing in 84 when I got started. So we're trying more difficult things, and we're using the same thinking about people and how to work with people and how people work together. So this is why I'm happy to look at the three of you and go, yeah, it's too late for me, but you guys need to be sharing this information. And that's why I'm happy to be on the podcast. It gives us a chance to start having the conversation that when you're dealing with knowledge workers, you can't treat them as fungible items. They're just not the same. So I was violently agreeing with you, in case you didn't recognize it.
I got it. No, I don't like the idea of funeral solutions dying, because that means you won't be with us someday, and that makes me sad. But you're not part of the problem either, and I think there's plenty of people in your generation, a lot of our friends, a lot of people who've been on this show that agree with us. I think I've made it abundantly known. I'm now a trainer with Scrum.org, and a lot of people are really big into the Scrum Master classes, the Product Owner classes. I've started to really specialize and focus in on the leadership course. So we have a professional Agile leadership course, and what I'm really trying to do in that class is work with middle management. Because I think, yes, I think there's some intersections that need to be focused on. I think one of them is definitely that 30 to 40-year-old. That I think that's a sweet spot for the next generation of leaders. But I think hitting middle management with some of these truths, or trying to get some light bulb moments around people are not interchangeable parts. People are, they have their own unique skills and backgrounds and experiences and insights, and that diversity is important. Not only diversity of culture, but diversity of thought. And diversity of race, gender, creed, religion, all of that comes together to create really high-performing, high-functioning teams. But I'm really focused in on, you know, how do we work with these people in ways that, you know, basically we can bust the myths of Taylorism, which is honestly what we're doing. We're basically busting the myths of factory work versus knowledge work. I think that's part of it. But also showing that by giving up perceived control, we actually gain more information. And trying to create those moments as well.
Well, and that's what's interesting is you use the phrase perceived control. The project management techniques that are widely used today, and are even forced on Agile projects that I've seen, believe that we can control everything. And everything's perfectly under control right up until we don't make delivery. And so there's this thing called the 90% law of projects, which says the first 90% of a project takes 90% of the time. The last 10% of the project takes that same 90% of the time. Because if you don't allow for fast feedback, small iterations, small bites, what you do is you build up this great big pile of stuff, and it looks like everything's going well right until it doesn't. And what I find sad and intriguing is we still have that same view today as we did back in 1984. I did work with a client who experienced the same shift, but they were doing an Agile tech. They were using Scrum, to be precise, and they were very transparent with the client. So the client actually was aware of the fact that we weren't going to make the deliveries that upper management, in this case, it was one of the senior VPs, made commitments to the client at the VP level. But at the work level, everybody could track and say, yeah, that's not going to happen. And the client was aware of it, and they were able to make their plans accordingly, instead of just coming up to the end of the, I guess it was 9 months, and going, oh, we haven't got anything for you yet. So there is hope. There are companies that are doing some things in better fashions, but I still see a lot of the same old, You know, we're going to believe this fantasy that we are in control right up until we're not. And so if you think about it, if in terms of Canevin, we try to operate in the obvious domain, and then it blows up. We slide into chaos, and then we kind of work ourselves around in chaos and come maybe back into complicated. And then we make believe we're in obvious domain again, and we can project when things will be done. One of the differences between factory work and knowledge work is factory work is built on repetition and on knowledge and being able to subdivide the task. Software development, this goes back to Fred Brooks and No Silver Bullet, and I've talked about this before on the show, I believe. Software development is novel. Every time you do something in software, it's new and different. Because if you're rewriting code that other people have already written, one, you're wasting time, and two, you're going out of business because somebody is way far ahead of you. So if everything you do is new and different, how do you estimate that work? You know, you can't say with any certainty that this is going to take me 4 days or 2 hours, you know. That's one of the benefits of small chunks of work.
If I can jump in, the small chunks of work thing you mentioned earlier on also is, I think, one of the key ingredients explaining why middle managers are so often in the predicament that they're in, which is why I'm grateful that Ryan is currently focusing on them. I think one of the things middle managers don't have, Esther Derby likes to mention this, I remember learning it from her, how many middle managers have been, or managers in general, have received training on how to do managing? Very few. So that's one. And I think middle managers more so than other managers. Secondly, what do middle managers who maybe haven't received training think is expected of them? Probably to make the thing look good. And then when it really fails, everybody understands that things really fail at the end. Okay, so it'll be tough, but it'll be understood. And then third, the thing that they're really missing is any feedback to the contrary from that. Not only from the people, like their managers, that would say, this is the way I wanted the project to go, or this is not the way I wanted the project to go, but also just from the process itself, the stakeholders seeing something and saying yes or no, good or bad, almost, not quite. A lot of times in a situation where you have middle managers, they are, the design of the work disconnects them from that kind of feedback. And so, of course, they wouldn't learn in a situation like that. And of course, when Ryan offers a way for them to try a new thing, I think those are the people that maybe need it the most.
Well, I think the design separates them from work is part of the statement. The other part is the organizational design is what creates the design of the work, the workflow, and causes that separation. Absolutely.
And that is the same separation I think that you led with, Don, which is about whether Agile is a set of values or things that we do. And is it really meaningful to say that it's one exclusively or the other? I'm not one of the people that made that manifesto, but I bet for them it wasn't exclusively one or the other. I think values is where they came to some agreement. I think if they'd known about the spine model, it would have made a shorter, more effective meeting. But that's essentially what they did. They found a level where they did agree, and that's the values. But at the same time, I think each of them had very concrete ideas about, in their view, how you enact those values, what you do on a day-to-day, minute-to-minute, second-to-second basis to do things at work that are consistent with those values. And so I was listening to something related to this on a walk the other day. I was listening to the Developer on Fire podcast, and they were interviewing Eric Evans, who created Domain-Driven Design, wrote the book about it upwards of a decade ago. And he was reflecting on how this book has aged, which I think is relevant to how the Agile Manifesto has aged. So one of the insights he had is that he knew, at least in retrospect now, he knew as he was writing this book that parts of it would be more timeless than other parts. The parts that would be more timeless were more about principles, and the parts that would be less timeless were more about applications. But he also had this idea as he was writing the book that it wouldn't do to leave out code examples. One of the things that he was trying to do better than in the industry was architecture ideas without concrete implementations, just pie in the sky. He wanted to show that domain-driven design is real when it reaches down into the day-to-day code base that you live with. So he had to give examples. They feel old to him now, because it's been upwards of a decade, but he couldn't imagine leaving them out of the book. And so I wonder if there's some analog with the Agile Manifesto that maybe if they had included a little more, here are the things we believe today that this means, we expect these to change. Maybe that would have given us more to go on, and then we wouldn't have such a puzzle now figuring out how to enact it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that we've got a puzzle, because over the last couple of, months, I've kind of been working with areas that aren't software development. I've recently attended a conference, HR Goes Agile, and it seems to be picking up in the South African market where the HR professionals are starting to pay attention to Agile and going, well, how does this affect us and what do we need to do differently as HR professionals and executives and companies that provide services in HR? What do we need to look at that has been done in the software industry to understand how this impacts us in the organization, and what do we need to change? And it was quite interesting kind of listening to some of the talks that were at that conference, because it took me back to the early days of my Agile journey and thinking, well, we've got to appreciate that the people we're expecting to change, the people we're expecting to get this, are only just starting on their journey. They don't understand all the things that the software industry has gone through to get to where they are today, to be asking the questions that we're asking today.
And to be fair, the software industry also doesn't understand everything the software industry has learned today.
Exactly. Yeah. How can we be the example when we don't know what it is that we're doing? Because the mental models that people outside of software have is that you can predict it. You know for sure how a project is going to execute, and you know how much it's going to cost, and you know what resources you need. And it's when we get to just that word that we're interpreting it in different ways.
The phrase knowledge work in itself is such a gauntlet thrown down. It's a phrase, it's a set phrase, we all say it, but it's also an instruction. It's work to deal with knowledge that we didn't previously know. And as humans, with the circuitry that we have and the experiences that we have, is relatively difficult to know how to do. It's knowledge work in the sense that any given day, we are making so many hypotheses, whether we know it or not, with so many confounding variables, whether we can control some of them or not, that any given moment, the basis for some supposed cause and effect that we're thinking in our heads may or may not be true anymore. Maybe it never was true. Maybe we have a reason we think it is, but it turns out to be wrong. It's knowledge work to figure out what do we know and why do we know it, and does it apply here? Does it apply now? All the time. And I think this is difficult for us at our best, and it is impossible for us under less than decent conditions. It's just a really hard thing to do, and it's a new kind of work.
You know what, Don? I have another heretical idea for you.
I need another one.
I think we're talking to the wrong people.
We're in an echo chamber.
Total echo. I think in 2019, I'm not going to speak at an Agile conference. I'm going to speak at PMI conferences, HR conferences, compliance conferences. I think I'm going to try to go completely outside of our echo chamber and spend a year giving no estimates talks to PMI groups and giving agile leadership.
They can't hate you any more than the agile group does.
That's true. That's true. I mean, and giving these professional agile leadership talks to HR groups and do, you know, agile hiring for HR. Really, I think part of the problem is that we're just so good at running off to a coach camp and patting each other on the back and saying, hey, we're all doing great stuff. And in reality, are we actually inspecting and adapting our progress in the real world? And sometimes I think we do, sometimes I think we don't, but this echo chamber stuff, this is the first year where I just sat back and thought, wow, this is really, there's an echo here that I had never really picked up on before.
So I would wonder if you really want to talk about agile leadership, because as soon as you use the word agile, you invoke and encourage all of the baggage and all of the feelings that come along with the word agile, whether it's a mindset, it's a manifesto, whether it's a set of practices. What would happen instead if you talked about real life and how do we manage in an uncertain environment? You know, bringing certainty to uncertain projects. How can we do that? Now, you're going to find that a lot of the things you're going to talk about, small slices, running tested features, exploratory work, exploratory coding, that's going to be very similar to the stuff you talk about with Agile. I mean, that's at some point when we get down to it, that's what one of the things Agile has really done for us is it shifted us, some of us, from these monolithic projects, which when I started, you know, it was nothing to go 18 months between the time you got the final specification and you delivered the first, oh, wait, this doesn't work part of the project. And in fact, back then I had a 70% rule, which was if you could get 70% of what the user really wanted on the first release, you were doing really good. The second release, you get another 70% of what's left. And hopefully it doesn't take another 18 months because you're building on something you've already written. I'm wondering about the value of saying it's agile. No, it's dealing with what's in front of us. One of the things that we're talking about in the GROWS method right now is actuals, not proxies. I think a lot of people have inherited metaphors such as factory. I've heard the phrase software factory. Drives me nuts because the two activities are diametrically opposed. You cannot get farther apart and stay in the same universe. But we're not looking at our data. We're looking at what we want. If we actually start to look at data, we'll know that all of our projects take three times longer than we estimated at the beginning. So we could just admit up front that it's going to take three times longer than what the management wants or the whoever wants it wherever. You know, so I hate to use management as, you know, the straw man, you know, like sometimes we use Taylorism. We go, ooh, Taylor bad. I don't know that that's useful for us. It's like, fine, what's the data and how can we improve what we're doing? And I think a lot of the practices and principles that we use in Agile will go forward. The exact values, I don't know, they may be rewritten. Tim talks about, once again, Tim Ottinger talks about modern Agile, which is a slight spin on the original four values. So I think it was a good, I love it. I think it's a good start. I'm thinking it's now got enough baggage that we don't need to talk about it. We just need to do things.
Well, that's the other. So I actually, Faye Thompson and I did a keynote in Las Vegas last month. And we did the collaborative curiosity format where we took, I think, 14 or 15 questions from the audience and wove it into some interesting keynote for people, went over very, very well. People were super happy with it. But one of the questions was, is Agile a mindset or a set of practices? And this question comes up almost every time we do that. I think Amitai and I got that question when we did this in New York. I've gotten it multiple times in Columbus and in Indianapolis. And I finally sat down with a dictionary and found nothing that made me happy. And so I opened up a French dictionary. And I did. And because I think the French have amazing words. And a friend of mine, I'm going to call him out here, David Furio, a former colleague here in Chicago, sat down with him and talked to him about some words that could make sense. And we found this word, habitude. And the word habitude is basically habits or actions combined with an attitude. And I thought, this so far is the best word that I've found. Because look, if you say Agile is a mindset, you cannot powerful question, wish, or think your way to delivery. You cannot do it. And if you think it's just practices, then it's soulless mechanical practices because you've left the mindset behind. So when someone says, is Agile a set of practices or a mindset? My answer is no. It's neither. It is a combination of habits that we cultivate. Yes, that's the spelling. A set of habits that we cultivate, influenced and informed by mindset, principles, ethics, however you want to phrase it. So it's honestly the two things. And so far, habitude, and that, you know, someday I just want to do a book called Habitude and really dig into this, or do a series of podcasts or series of blog posts. Anyone's interested, we can pair up. But I think habitude is what it is. And I now coach to that. If people are just walking around saying Agile is just a mindset, I'm like, great. You know, wish your way to shipping next week. You know, tell me about how the way you're thinking right now is going to make it happen, because we still have to go do the work.
Interesting. I heard the word habitude never by itself when I studied French in high school. I only ever heard it as d'habitude, which is of habit, usually. It's how people say usually. And so if habitude has a direct English translation, it must be something like what you usually do. And so for me, I think this ties back to where did this manifesto come from? It didn't come from people who sat and dreamed about values all day long. They came from people who were busy and were trying to generalize from it. They were engaged in habitual behaviors. They had habitudes, if I'm using this right. And they got together to say, what is it about this that's working better for us than the other stuff that we've done or the other stuff that other people have done? And then they went up to values. And it's true for me. How do people learn stuff? We're talking about how we wish middle managers would learn something, how we wish the industry would learn something. How did I learn these values? Not because somebody told them to me. I learned them because I happened to land in a team that was performing behaviors that you would identify with extreme programming. And then I could maybe understand why later the values would be something that was important to them. But to begin with, it was just, what are we doing every day? Later, I could think about why and, you know, what behaviors might be as good or better. But we start with doing. We're animals. We start with doing.
Well, and the dictionary, thanks for the kind of the add-on to the word. If you just look up the word habitude in the dictionary or you Google it, it's a habitual tendency or way of behaving. And I think that's such a... That to me is just, that's where it's at for me. That's the way that I think about Agile. It's this habitual tendency or the way that we behave, and it's influenced by the manifesto, but it's behaviors, it's actions, and yeah. there's it's tendencies. It's not locked in stone. It's malleable. We can change it, and I think that's so important to think of it that way, or else we just get lost.
Yeah, it makes me think of something I always keep top of mind when I'm in a coaching session or interacting with teams or individuals is how we talk to each other. And that would just be the one thing that we focus on. But it can often underpin a lot of the other things that we do as teams or as humans interacting with each other. It's underpinned by how we talk to each other and what are our attitudes towards each other when we're dealing with each other. And for me, that's a bigger part of software development than the actual software development. Being successful at software development is for me, that's the big part of it, rather than the writing of code.
I think that's critical, and I really like that. I also want to key back in. Amitai, you made a comment about we wish management would do things, and I think, Barry, you were amplifying this. We wish people would do things. If only X would happen, Y would be better. And the other thing that has helped me, because I used to do that too, it's only if those silly managers, and I was a director in the Fortune 500 for a number of years, so I was one of the problems, right? It's like, man, if only these people would do this or that. And it was actually Christopher Avery's teachings through the responsibility process where I realized, nope, it's on me. I am 100% responsible for exactly where I'm at, what's going on, and what's happening to, for, and around me. And if I can't, well, a tornado might hit and I can't be responsible for that. But I'm responsible for the way I respond to those things that are out of my control. And so regardless of whether there's a manager doing something weird or, you know what? What did I do to not coach in a way that resonated with that manager? If there's a developer who's unhappy about adopting Scrum, well, what did I do to not create a space of co-creation and invitation where that developer would be comfortable? I mean, that kind of thinking alone, along with kind of breaking out of this echo chambers thing and trying to look at, you know, some of the silliness in our community, some of the pluses, the minuses, and really just trying to be responsible as opposed to a victim or a dreamer or wishing for things to be different has just made this year completely different for me. And I can't recommend these things enough. I think Slack by DeMarco is foundational to what we do. I think Christopher Avery's book, The Responsibility Process, can change the life of a Scrum Master or an Agile coach. I think jumping out of the echo chamber and checking out some other practices and other disciplines could be huge. You know, I think Amitai and Barry have hit on some really cool humanistic aspects of what we're doing. And I think that's all important. I cannot, this will be my 2019, is getting these principles and practices around leadership and thinking and responsibility into the mainstream. Like, this will be my charge January 1 of next year.
You know, that makes me think, I just recently, I don't know if we're leaving this topic behind yet or not, but it makes me think of something. I've recently identified at a few coach camps something that seems to be kind of a specialty for me. Maybe it's a mission for me in the year going forward, which is, I feel like, so for coaches who are somehow estranged or feel estranged from doing development work. In other words, they feel like they could sit with managers and talk about planning and risks. They could run, they could set up a card wall, they can run retros, but they shouldn't go sit next to a programmer. They wouldn't do any good and they'd get in the way. People who feel like that, who are coaches, I feel are coaching in a very difficult mode, because to me, the most important thing about that a coach does is to model behavior. And what is the behavior that a coach models when certain kinds of work they're not willing to join in? I feel like that makes it harder for everybody. And it's also the opposite of the advice that we would give an Agile team. An Agile team, we would wish that they would join each other in their work. But if we can't also do that in every possible way, where are they going to learn that from? People learn by doing, they maybe learn by watching other people do. So something that I've taken as perhaps a mission is, when I go to coach camps, at least, and maybe I could scale this up some more, I always offer sessions on TDD, sort of an analog to TDD, for non-programmers, and then mob programming, where we're really test-driving something in Python, for example, for non-programmers. And we only have an hour or less, but by the end of it, at least a few of these coaches who feel like they couldn't sit with programmers maybe feel a little bit more like they can. And I think that improves the likelihood that these coaches connect better with many more of the people that they work with, which makes it more likely that the coaching is effective and more likely that people's lives improve. And so it seems like an important thing that I've hit on, and I haven't yet made it a mission the way that you've made your 2019 mission, but maybe I should.
I think we have to decide what's important and start pushing that. I'm drinking my first cup of coffee in like 20 years, so I'm probably fired up. Which I don't know why I've been skipping coffee so long. It's amazing. So first of all, Amitai, your session at Coach Camp, you did this in, I think I saw the one in St. Louis where you paired up and were writing. So it was like kind of intro to pair programming for non-programmers, and I'm glad you're doing mob kind of stuff with it too. That's really awesome. That it showed me that. So I haven't written code in 10 years, but I even felt comfortable recently getting back in because of your course or because of your workshop. It kind of gave me the confidence to sit down and go, even if I don't know the syntax anymore, I can still contribute. And so it was really cool to see that that play out like that. But I also think, you know, if we're taking up charges for the year, I think we have to be intentional. You know, I think I especially probably spend too much time on self-promotion and talks that kind of amuse me rather than advance the profession of software. And that's something that I've been putting a lot of thought into lately, is how am I making the profession of software development better? And am I doing that consistently, or am I just self-promoting, or am I just amusing myself? And that's something that I think, I mean, I'm not saying anyone on here is doing anything wrong, but I think when we get more intention around that kind of mission and really kind of pushing that forward, I think it makes the community better. And for me, it's something that I'm thinking about. I don't know if you guys think about that as well, but it's just, that's been front of mind a lot lately.
Well, and I think for me, you mentioned something that's a false comparison. I think something that amuses you could greatly help the industry. I don't see these two as opposites. I think that would be even better, is to, hey, this is fun, let's go have some fun and make the world a better place.
I totally agree that's possible. But Don, the comment, and you've made these comments to me before about, you know, it's the 30s and 40s, the people in the 30s, and you call us the kids or the whippersnappers.
The kids. But it's the kids. But y'all just, anyway, go ahead.
No. I appreciate that. I turned 40 next year, and I'm not feeling like a kid anymore. But so I like it when you say that. But I think if those of us in that group, you know, the Amitais and the Berries and myself and, you know, all of the others on the show that come on, if we're not intentional about helping the community and what to do next, I think we miss this really amazing opportunity, especially with the millennials coming up in the work ranks, to really change the world of work. I mean, I think there is this kind of golden moment coming that we're going to have to jump on and be very cognizant and aware of, or else I think this opportunity is just going to slip by.
Well, jump.
Yes. Oh, we are. Right? Hey, I'm all in. If only someday we'll sit down and talk about all the activity going on behind the scenes. But I know all of us are very busy mentoring, working with people, trying to get ready for that next wave. And I don't mean Agile 2.0, or I don't mean what's after Scrum. I just mean, because Don has posed another question in our Agile for Humans Slack channel. And no, I'm sorry, everybody, we can't sell access. I get a lot of questions about that. If you've been on the show, you have access to the Slack channel. So if you want access to the Slack channel, come up with something cool and be on the show. That's the only, there's no cost. It's just contribute back to the community and you're in. And it is an amazing place. But something that Don's even been talking about is, I just lost it.
He talked beyond his thoughts.
I finally had a senior moment like Don.
Welcome to my world.
What is this?
What happens? Oh, so
it'll come back. You can take it, Don.
Well, so you talked about being intentional, you know, I've been involved with the GROWS method. Andy Hunt and Tony Brill. Sadly, Jared is no longer with us.
It is very sad.
Tony and Andy and I have been reworking it a little bit because we had a lot of practices that were good practices, but we didn't really have a framework on that we could point to going, this is from where these practices come. So what we've done is we've created four what we call seeds, because, you know, it fits the metaphor of growing. And one of the seeds is called intentional, not accidental. And so the way you can be intentional is you use experiments, look at lean flow cues, have problem solve, know how to solve problems. And here's when I typed this in the chat window. It's called knowledge as an expiring asset. If you're not actively learning all the time, you're falling behind. There is no stationary. You cannot stay where you are. You're either moving forward or you're losing. And even as you move forward, in our domain, the world is expanding faster than any one person can keep up with it. So, you know, you've got to keep learning. And then, well, that's the next part, is just keep learning and then try new stuff based on the experiments. Try new processes, try new things. So that's the intentional, not accidental seed that I just, the topics that we have under there. And everybody's busy reading the chat window.
No, just thinking. I mean, I wish that thought would come back because I think it was a good one. It's gone.
Well, when it comes back to you, you can always splice it into the podcast before you put it up.
It happens. So
it made me think, as Don was talking, and I can't remember who, I think it was you, Ryan, was talking about the millennials and the millennials coming through into organizations and into software development. And one of the things we're often taken aback by is that they don't have the mental models that people in organizations that we deal with do. So very often when we're training or running boot camps or whatever we're doing, we're dealing with a group of people that have mental models that have been formed in organizations and over years of working that we're trying to help them to unlearn. And the millennials that are coming straight out of college have only read it in a book or been taught it by a lecturer or a professor at university. So when they come into the working world, they've never seen it in practice, so don't necessarily have those broken mental models. And that's potentially a group that we need to consider when, like an entirely new group that we need to consider through all of this. What sparked that thought was Don talking about knowledge as an expiring asset. With the millennials coming through into the working environment, those things that they do are expiring a lot quicker than we do. The millennials tend to start a new job, and when something comes up, they move on a lot quicker than we would have in the past. We stick at jobs for a lot longer, and our parents, like Don, would have stuck to a job their whole life and worked with one company their whole lives.
It's very true. My dad started with the company that he retired from 40 years prior. I mean, he started as a driver and retired a vice president. And for 40 years, same company through mergers, acquisitions, all of those things. And today, in my first job, I actually started down that path and got 12 years in with a company and then kind of woke up one day and was like, whoa, that's not how the world works anymore. And so now it's more, you know, 1 or 2 year stints or platoons. And now it's even getting, in all honesty, I'm getting to the point where it's like, wow, 3 months is a long time. You know?
Well,
maybe you are a whippersnapper.
You're an old millennial is what you are.
I've been called worse by better people, Don.
Yeah, this is not a competition.
So
there is one. Go ahead.
Agile for Humans has a fan favorite, John Cutler. He's been on a couple times. He lives more in the product development space than a lot of us do. And I don't know if he's talked about it on the show, but he's definitely talked about it on Twitter and on his very productive blog, where he's he's found it useful to just not try to re-educate the millennials because they don't have those mental models that that we need to get rid of and people who have been around longer. They haven't learned these stuck old ideas. They expect work to kind of make sense and kind of have meaning and kind of give feedback. And claims to be the opposite of that doesn't make sense. And anything that claims to be that, almost obvious for them in his experience, if I'm summarizing it right. So that might be an interesting thing to link to if we can find a blog post about it from John.
Well, and there's actually a really good blog post from Steve Porter, who's been on the show, and he's with Scrum.org, where he was talking about a training class. I think he did the professional Scrum Master training with a group of all millennials. And a lot of our teachings are designed to create these light bulb moments. And a lot of it's to contrast traditional ways of working with new and to try to cause these awakenings or the kind of these moments of introspection. And what he found in his blog post was that with the millennials, it's getting harder because, as Amitai, you were saying, they don't have the old mental models. The stuff that we're teaching just seems obvious. Like, yeah, why wouldn't you want to do things kind of small and get feedback and make sure it's the right thing? That just seems logical. And it is changing the way that we train. It's changing the way that we approach these courses. And it's really been interesting because, you know, now that I've been teaching a number of classes, I'm seeing it too, where someone will say, yeah, I understand that's how all of you old people did it, but that's not how it works anymore. That's not what we're taught in school. And I'm like, I guess I have to think differently about this. And it is a fascinating shift to watch. And I'll get a link to Steve's blog post as well, because it was really, really good.
That pregnant pause was brought to you by Don unmuting his microphone.
We have a sponsor for the show. It's exciting. You'll get an invoice afterwards, buddy.
Well, I'll file it with all the other ones. Good luck. As we used to say in South Dakota, we'll charge it to the rain, charge it to the dust, and let the rain settle it. Anyway, no, it had to do with this concept of people coming into the workforce who do not have some of the metaphors and frameworks that those of us who've been around for a while have. And it reminded me of the saying, one of my favorite things is when somebody says, how do I motivate someone? The first question should be, well, what are you doing that demotivates them? Because if you stop doing that, they probably will be motivated. So there's no need to teach them things they shouldn't know. I'm wholeheartedly agreeing. Let's just dispense with teaching them things they don't need to know. There's enough stuff that they do need to learn.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the profession of software delivery is changing, and we're seeing shifts. And cool. I we just have to be aware of that.
I too old to be a millennial?
Yes.
Oh, damn.
Yes, you are. I think I am, too. I think I'm Gen X. But I don't know, Barry, you might be millennial, right? No, a millennial would never talk while on mute.
That's right.
True.
Technically, anyone who can redefine the start of the counting system in a calendar system can be a millennial. We just have to say, you know, move it to where Don is some multiple of thousands.
There you go. Well, I'll tell you what, guys. I think we've hit our time box for this one. And I'm sure we've said some things that have gotten some people thinking. And I always appreciate the Don the Heretic coming on the show and stirring the pot and taking advantage of a hyper-caffeinated me. So that's good. So at this point of the show, you guys are all veterans. You know what's up. This is your time to shine, your time to promote, sell, shameless plugs, whatever you got. Barry, how can people continue the conversation with you? Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever it is that you like, and then anything you've got to promote.
Cool, yeah. I'm Twitter, Barry Tandy. Keep the conversation going there. Otherwise, LinkedIn, same, Barry Tandy. And yeah, I think plugs. My head at the moment is on conferences. We're organizing the regional Scrum Gathering in November in South Africa. It's in Durban. And we're lucky to be having Esther as one of our keynotes and Don as one of our other keynotes. So it's going to be a great conference, and we hope to see some more of you there, 8th to 9th of November in Durban, South Africa.
That's going to be amazing. Thanks for sharing that, and hopefully you do see a few. I checked the stats the other day, and I know that there are a number of people in South Africa listening to the show now, and so hopefully you do see some listeners show up and check out the event.
Cool.
Amitai, what's up with you?
Yo. So as usual, Schmanz on Twitter, schmanz.com for my blog, Agile in 3 Minutes for my micro podcast. A particular episode of Agile in 3 Minutes relevant to what we talked about today would be episode number 24 called Invalidate, which has the question, how do you know what you think you know? And that's a good one to follow up from here today. As for me, by the time you hear this episode, I will probably have begun my coding tour, where I visit 5 or 6 different companies, mostly in Germany, a little bit in the UK, a week each, just to program with them and pair with them, mob with them, learn from them, teach them a thing or two if I know anything that they can use. And at the end of it, I should have a bunch of blog posts and little video interviews, and we'll have learned a lot. That's my training for this year as I'm going on coding tour. And I'm going to share what I learned with you on my blog. And finally, I have some availability back in the States in Q4 in the New York area. And for that, you can go to my consulting site, latentagility.com.
Very good. We'll get links to all of that in the show notes. My great and good friend, Don Gray, what do you got, sir?
So to continue the conversation on Twitter, it's Donald E. Gray. I had no idea there were so many Donald Grays in the world. All my life, I thought I was unique. But the E does make me unique, so at Donald E. Gray. Twitter, donaldegray.com for the website. Let's see, speaking this year, coming up, I have the Agile Conference 2018. I will be speaking on improving interactions. So if you're there, come by, find me. We can chat. Then after that, Esther and I will be holding the fall Problem Solving Leadership Workshop, again, sold out in September. And then November, I'm back for the third year in a row to South Africa, which is a great place to go. A lot of wonderful people there doing Agile practices, mindset. They're habituating. There it is. Habituating Agile there. So that's what it looks like for me at this time.
That is awesome. So we'll get links to all of that in the show notes as well. Really excited for you guys about Durban. It's really cool that Don and Esther are heading there to keynote. I know there's a lot of great submissions. And actually, something...
Hang on. I forgot. Sorry. And immediately after, can I share that yet, Barry? Yeah. Oh, I got the thumbs up. Esther and I will be doing a Coaching Beyond the Team.
Nice.
In South Africa the week after Scrum Gathering Durban.
Nice.
Yep. The links to that should be going up in the next week, I hope.
You know, I did Don and Esther's Coaching Beyond the Team in Columbus this year. It's really helped me in my current role. I was having difficulties with conversations with certain people, and it's really helped me. The center, enter, turn concept is just amazing. And actually, I've used it in my personal life as well. It's been if you're in South Africa and you have an option to check that out, highly, highly recommend it. It's really, really good. It's one of the few workshops I've gone to where I thought, yeah, I'm glad I'm here. This one was good. So as for me, as always, I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. My big focus right now is on training. And as I mentioned, I'm really focused on professional agile leadership. If that sounds interesting to you, get a hold of me. We'd really love to talk to you more about that course. It's really turning into something special for especially middle management, but even helping Scrum Masters find ways to speak to middle management in more effective ways has really been cool. But yeah, check that out. But that's really been my focus lately as a professional Scrum Master and professional Agile leadership. Really excited about those courses. Other than that, I have a few more conference stops this year, but I think my schedule is clearing up really for training and other activities like that. But yeah, at Ryan Ripley on Twitter, RyanRipley.com, and let's connect and continue the conversation. So as always, you know, thank you everybody out there. If you've made it to this point, you're at the end of the show, and I think you all are the real rock stars for listening all the way through. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for sharing the show. Please keep sending those links out. I love seeing LinkedIn, Twitter, all of those different social media platforms where people are sharing the show and talking about the great value they get from it. If I were a better marketer, I would collect those and promote those somehow. I need to get better at that, but I love seeing it and really appreciate all the great feedback. Please keep it coming. If there's someone you'd like to see on the show, if there's a topic, if there's a way that we can help, you know, please fire that off. I know all of us would love to see feedback on the show and the ways that we can help add value to your lives. And so let us know, and we're open to that feedback. All right, that's enough of that. I am your host, Ryan Ripley, wishing everybody a wonderful, it's still morning, so let's say morning.
Thanks for listening to Agile for Humans. Let's keep the conversation going. Drop us a question on Twitter @AgileForHumans or visit agileforhumans.com.